Now, what we're dealing with here, as I think what's happened in Libya, is you have a genuine uprising by ordinary people who want to change things, but it pretty quickly turned into a battle. We know that the Islamic Fighting Group in Libya have worked with British intelligence for years. They were contracted to kill Gaddafi by MI6, according to Annie Mashon, who worked for MI5. Basically, I don't trust the West to do these things right. I don't believe it when Sarkozy and Cameron claim to be humanitarians. I just don't believe it. And I think what needs to happen in Misrata is a ceasefire. Incidentally, I read it earlier on the internet, and then people pointed this out, it's quite clear, Gaddafi has recaptured several towns. He hasn't massacred the inhabitants of those towns he's recaptured. He's fighting the rebels. Yeah, just as we fought the IRA and we're fighting the Taliban. If, you know, that's war. Gaddafi is not just going to surrender his state to outside forces or internal forces who are using weapons on him. If it's fighting, it's fighting. And look, are they going to win the West in this case? I suspect not. They're not going to win in Iraq, they're not going to win in Afghanistan, and they're not going to win in Libya either. But I tell you who is winning. The military-industrial complex is making a packet. Every drone that's fired is money going ching-ching to some people.
Well, in British aerospace part of which is, of course, is based here in Bristol.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, of course, we're arming the Saudis from Bristol up here. Now, if I was a Saudi patriot who wanted a democracy in my country, I might conclude that people up at Filton who are getting a nice living out of selling weaponry to my government, they're my enemies. Perhaps what we need at Filton is a little car bomb, just to remind you that war is war, and you are making weapons, chaps, and you're giving those weapons to the Saudis, the people who break testicles and electrocute and flog. They are, you're saying to young Saudis, we, the British people, are your enemies, but we want to go home and have a nice cup of tea. We are going to get a hell of a shock if we carry on down this road. It's about time Britain woke up and realised what road we're on. We're on a collision course with the rest of the world. We are not regarded as the good guys in the majority of the planet. And if we carry on with this belligerent attitude, we will get what we deserve.
Right, Martin, thank you very much. Now, a Good Friday situation report from the Holy Land. Moving east slightly from Libya, on tensions being stoked up by the religious fanatics of 2011, from the Haifa-born son of a 1940s civil servant in British-controlled Palestine.
Hello, I'm Peter Riley. I was actually born in Haifa in Palestine before it became Israel. Our family went on holiday but couldn't return. The Irgun, the Jewish terrorist group, attacked Haifa in 1948. My mother's brothers and sisters and families fled to Lebanon. They took with their keys and their property deeds but weren't able to return. But actually that's the story of the way Israel was born. It's born on terrorism. My father was extremely well paid as a senior civil servant there, and the job opportunities weren't the same in England. I mean, we had a very good lifestyle, and when we came to England, we had pretty hard times. Now, he had no intention of leaving. In fact, my mother wanted to go back, but she could have only gone back to Lebanon, and she was really homesick. She often talked about it and often cried. My father was an administrator in the Ministry of Food. He worked for the British. He was a civil servant. My mother was a Palestinian of Lebanese descent. She was brought up in Palestine. And she told me many of the stories that we heard on the recent Channel 4 documentary called The Promise, a four-part documentary. I could relate that quite well, particularly Diyasin, which happened in April when the Irgun attacked the village in the dead of night and slaughtered three-quarters of the population. This is what led to the fleeing of Palestinians all over from a number of villages. About three-quarters of a million fled because they feared being massacred. They were unarmed. In the TV programme, The Promise, when the Jewish Irgun were asked, why are you turning against the British? Because they saved you from the Nazis. And their answer was, because they're in the way. And we were in the way because in the Balfour Declaration in 1917, when we promised a home for the Jews, in the same sentence, we promised to protect the rights of the non-Jewish population. In doing so, we obviously had to limit the amount of immigration, but this wasn't in the Jewish plan. They wanted all for themselves, as they do now. It's pretty obvious.
How did the Irgun, who were the Jewish terrorists of their day, how did they actually manage to make so many people get on the move?
Well, just terrorism, terrorising them. Of course, they terrorised the British. They blew up the King David Hotel. They assassinated a number of British people. My mother said they used to set booby traps on the roads to blow up the jeeps. They put bombs in the marketplaces, Arab marketplaces. This was particularly to try and get the Jews to boycott Arab marketplaces. But they terrorised. The reason why the British handed it over to the United Nations was because they couldn't cope with the terrorism against them. So they left it to the United Nations to sort out the problem. And you probably know that the United Nations decided to partition Palestine. But on the map, they gave the majority of the land to a minority of the people. The Jews were still a minority, only about 33% of the population. They only owned about 6% of the land, and yet they were given nearly 60% of the land.
Some of those people must have moved voluntarily. You can't get 750,000 people just to leave their homes.
Why would they leave voluntarily? They left because they were feared massacres. There was a massacre in DS, and there were a number of massacres. Now, the best source of this is from Milan Pape, who was a professor of history at Haifa University. He's an Israeli, he's a Jew. His most recent book is called The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. He looked at the IDF archives in Hebrew, and he saw the Dalit plan was a plan from the word go to ethnically cleanse the Palestinians, and he claims it's still their policy now. They may not be massacring them in quite the same way, but the pressure on their lives, the closures, all the pressure on the Palestinians is really to drive them out.
What was this Dalit plan you mentioned there?
The D plan, a Dalit plan, is a plan to ethnically cleanse Palestine from the non-Jewish population.
Well, you say is, but actually it's a historic thing.
Yes, but the plan is continuing. According to Alain Pape, the whole of Israeli policy is to intimidate the Palestinians, to make life so difficult for them that they leave. For example, in Bethlehem, which had a very sizable Christian population, most of them were in businesses selling tourism. Bethlehem's got a wall surrounding all sides with one entrance. The entrance is controlled by the Israelis. Tourists are bussed in on Israeli buses to the tourist areas and driven straight out into Israeli shops. They can't make a living, so they have to leave, and they are leaving. They're not leaving because of Arabs or Muslims or anything. They've got on very well with Muslims. In fact, one of my colleagues went there 2 years ago and she said, is there an issue between Muslims and Christians? And they said, no, it's not an issue. We don't even ask who what they are. They all got on well together. In fact, my mother told me when she was a child, the indigenous Jews there resented the immigration of European Jews because they set them against their Arab friends and neighbours on the grounds that if you're not with us, you're against us. And they didn't like that. It's a different culture. They resented the European Jewish culture.
To a certain extent, the ethnic cleansing, as you call it, is born of a kind of religious fundamentalism, actually quite a dangerous religious idea. They're on some sort of mission from God to ethnically cleanse. I mean, that sounds a bit of a strange idea, but do you think there's any credence to it?
There's a lot in it today, but it wasn't originally. Zionism started in the 1890s, and it was Herzl from Austria, an Austrian Jew, who was a secular Jew. He was an atheist. Zionism was born of a time when colonization was fashionable. There was a scramble for Africa. Every European country wanted a slice of Africa. They disregarded the rights of the indigenous population. They took the land and sold it amongst themselves. And that's exactly what the Jews were doing in Palestine. They didn't regard the people as humans. They didn't think they should have any rights at all.
Was this the case before the end of the Second World War, before the Gurn and the Stern Gang and people like this?
Yes, I mean, Zionism started, as I say, in the 1890s. There were pogroms in Russia. We all know how much the Jews did suffer, and I think that's absolutely horrific. But many of the Russian Jews came to Palestine even before 1900. They were first welcomed, according to General Glove, who wrote his book on the history of Palestine after World War One. He said the Palestinians welcomed the Jews as blood brothers. It was only after the Zionist conference in The Hague in 1922 when they saw the thin edge of the wedge, because the Jews had said they wanted a land for Jews as England is for Englishmen and America is for Americans. That's when the problem started.
Don't you think there's a bit of a problem here, though, that we're talking about the Jews, and yet there are very, very different types of people who are all of Jewish descent?
Of course. I mean, I'm not a racist. Perhaps that some of the Jews themselves are racist, particularly the Shabbat Lubavitch. We often hear of quotes from the Quran, and we quoted from Hamas and their charter to see what extremists the Muslims are, but we never read about how extreme some of these Jewish religious people are, fanatics are. I would agree, if going back to the first part, most of the settlers are in fact religious fanatics. They're very, very extreme. They're racist, they're bigoted, and Shabbat Lubavitch actually teach that the Jewish soul is divine, other souls are merely human or animal, and therefore Jews are superior to non-Jews, And nobody can steal land in Palestine from Jews because God gave it to the Jewish people. If that isn't racism, I don't know what is.
What is this group? Because I've not heard of them before.
Well, I'm not surprised, although they've got a budget of $22.2 billion for their international education centres. They've got at least 35 centres in Britain, about 12 universities in Britain. They're represented in every city in Europe, in every country in the world, every state of the United States. In the United States, they shake hands with political leaders. Their advice is sought by political leaders. Yet their ideology is extremely racist and supremacist.
So what is this organisation again, and what evidence have you that they actually think that they are somehow godlike?
You just read their own website. It is a Hasidic Orthodox Jewish group. I did do some research recently, and one website claimed that they were a cult rather than a religion. It's spelt C-H-A-B-A-D, Shabud Lubavitch, L-U-B-A-V-I-T-C-H. Nahida Yassin, who was herself a Palestinian refugee, her family was made a refugee in Jerusalem in 1948 and then in 1967. She's been doing a lot of research on it, and she's got a lot of information on a blog site called Uprooted Palestinians. You can read for yourself all the sources. She's quite a good scholar, and she hasn't said anything except from sources from Shabud itself.
Now, I'm surprised that we've not heard of this group. Why haven't we heard of it? Especially if you say, as you say, it's in different towns, universities, large parts of the Western world.
Where it is heard of, they say they do good. No doubt they do some good for the Jewish people. But what's not ever exposed is their ideology towards non-Jews. They would keep that to themselves. It's only in the Jewish press, in the Israeli press, and in their own websites where they're communicating with each other do they show their teachings. There are a number of rabbis who've come up with extreme things, such as the Palestinians should all die, they should kill the Palestinians, it doesn't matter if you kill Palestinian women and children. They take a lot of their material from the Old Testament. I mean, we say the Quran's pretty bad, but the Old Testament, I mean, one of them has said that the Palestinians are the modern-day Malachites. You know from the Bible, I think it was in Saul, God instructed the Jewish people to annihilate them. And there are more than one of these rabbis who said today's Amalekites are the Palestinians. And in fact, I think one of the members of the Knesset has said that the Iranians are as well.
So how do they justify this? Because it seems like they're almost dehumanizing people.
Because they're God's chosen people. God gave them a divine soul. Some of them say we are divine. Others are merely human. They actually say other people are there to serve Jews. I know that sounds terrible. And if I went to say this about Jews were there to serve the German people, this would be incredibly racist. And it's equally racist to say that non-Jews should be serving Jews. Obviously they don't make this widespread, but you can see for yourself that that's a hidden agenda. That's why they're getting away with the atrocities that they commit in Palestine and in Gaza.
Now, I'm sure we're all familiar with Islamists and Islamic extremists. Do you think that there's any kind of comparison between the two?
Well, I think these are worse. Actually, there's a great deal of exaggeration about the Islamists. The Islamists have actually stated, Hamas, they say they're not against Jews per se, they're against a Jewish state of Israel, i.e. a state which discriminates against non-Jews. I mean, you can't have a Jewish state and a democratic state at the same time. A lot of the Jewish academics state this. There are at least 20 laws which discriminate against non-Jews. But Hamas has said if they had a united Palestine, whether it's called Israel, Palestine or whatever, the Jews would be protected. And indeed, Jews found shelter in Muslim countries, of course, when they were being persecuted by the Christians. And that's historically accurate. It isn't against Jews per se. It's against a Jewish state of Israel which discriminates against non-Jews. For example, in 1948, 6% of the land in Israel was owned by Jews. Today, 96% is owned because land has not been redeemed until it's in the hands of the Jews. And non-Jews can't buy land. This is one of the 20 laws which discriminate against non-Jews.
Is there any kind of limit to the amount of land that this group claims the Bible has given them?
The extreme group talks about Greater Israel, which goes from the Nile to the Euphrates, and it's significant that Israel will not define its borders. When I was a child, and until quite recently, we all believed that the poor little Israelis were going to be thrown in the sea by the Arabs. But from an Arab perspective, they could just see the Jewish state was going to expand and expand and expand until they've got what they want from the Nile to the Euphrates. And that's the reality. I'm quite convinced that most of the wars in the Middle East are really in Israel's interest.
Where do you think this is all heading now? Because quite a lot of the tension is focused around the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is the site of the original Jewish temple in Jerusalem, which is also now a very sacred site to the Muslims, and who have got their mosque on the same site. Looking at that, that could be the focus for tension, but how do you see things going?
Well, one of the rabbis of Shabud Lubavitch has stated, if you tear down all their mosques and their cultural centres, etc., this will be one step to solving the problem, to make the state of Israel a purely Jewish state. I don't think they want peace. It's pretty obvious now. We've seen the revelations of the documents in the WikiLeaks that they've never wanted peace. One of the Jewish academics said they've had 28 opportunities for peace, but that they don't want peace because they want a greater Jewish state where the non-Jews either serve the Jews or leave or die. So I'm not very optimistic, particularly because of the great power they have in the United States. What people don't realise is they interview every candidate for either the Senate or Congress, AIPAC, America, Israel Public Affairs Committee, ask them questions about Israel, Palestine, etc. If they give the right answers, in inverted commas, they get loads of cash. If they give the wrong answers, the money is used to help the opposition or even in advertising campaigns against them. Everyone in the United States government has got to be a member of AIPAC. And if you look at their own websites and their annual conferences, you'll see politician after politician, leader after leader saying, we love Israel, Israel's our ally, we'll always support Israel no matter what. And that's indeed what they have been doing. They vetoed so many United Nations resolutions criticising Israel. For example, in Gaza, there was no attempt to actually even ask for a ceasefire, let alone have a no-fly zone. And Israelis have been able to get away with murder, literally.
You mentioning the United States, but hang on a minute. It's actually Britain where the Balfour Declaration was, and surely it's the fault of Britain who handed this land over and was the crucible for the whole Zionist movement.
Yes, you're right, but I've got a book called Palestine Papers 1917 to 1922. They're just documents and letters between Weissman and Samuels and Balfour, etc., Lloyd George. And the reason the Balfour Declaration was signed, because Weissman promised that if we signed this declaration, they could guarantee they would bring Americans into the First World War. I fully appreciate how much influence they have today, but I didn't realise they had so much influence then. And therefore, we signed the declaration in order to get the support of the Zionists to bring America into the war. But it wasn't our country to give them. What a cheek.
We also have conservative friends of Israel, Labour friends of Israel, and groups like this here in our parliament.
Yeah, and I do not understand how anyone can be a friend of a state of Israel, considering its policies has got the most right-wing extreme government you can think of. It seems to me in Israel there's right-wing, and very, very, very right-wing, absolutely racist regime. How people can be friends of Israel and a member of one of our democratic parties, I just don't understand. All I can tell you is this. Rosie Cooper, MP, from West Lancs, was written to by the West Lancs Peace and Justice Group about issues on Palestine and got a reply from the Foreign Office and sent it with her compliments. And our members went to see her to say, look, we were asking your opinions, we wanted your views on this. And she admitted she didn't know very much about it, though she was a friend of Israel. She said as soon as she was elected, she was whisked off to Israel on a educational, in inverted commas, tour, all expenses paid by the Friends of Israel, and signed up. And since then, she just receives information from the Friends of Israel, which is one-sided perspective of what's going on. She didn't know what was going on. Now, although she still remains a Friend of Israel, she is a very good MP. She's one of the few that is quite genuine. And she's been investigating it, and she's actually been speaking and asking questions on behalf of the Palestinians in Parliament. So, to answer your question, the MPs are, I wouldn't say got at, they are encouraged to join and given inducements to do so.
Whereabouts can people go on the internet to find out what their views of their MPs are on Israel-Palestine, and have you got any other websites you'd like to recommend?
It's very difficult to find whether an MP is a friend of Israel or a friend of Palestine or whatever. You can certainly see on the Friends of Israel website or the Friends of Palestine website, or whether Labour, Conservative or whatever, the key members, the committee members, but it's very difficult to find out who is and who isn't. One ought to just write to the MP and ask if there's a problem in being a Friends of Israel and being a member of a democracy. They claim that Israel, of course, is the only democracy in the Middle East, but of course it's not, because it doesn't represent the views of 20% of the population. Hamas, of course, was elected democratically, but they don't recognise that. But the websites I recommend for those absolute beginners, ifamericansknew.org, it's an American website, and it's got loads of information and lots of videos you can look at. I personally like uprootedpalestinians.blog.com. But that is a bit heavier going, they're quite detailed articles. If they want to campaign and get involved, there's the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, PSC. There's Palestine Monitor. There's Electronic Intifada, which is very good for news. Press TV is excellent.
Get your favourite one?
Uprooted Palestinians. It's a blog by eminent writers, including Gilad Asmos, I think, who is Jewish Israeli, who is very much an anti-Zionist. There are, of course, a number of anti-Zionist Jews. There are Jewish Voices for Peace. Again, they've got their own website. There's the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. They've got their own website. And there's the Israeli Association of Civil Rights. And if you want to know about discrimination in Israel, that's one of them to look at.
Well, that was Palestinian-born son of a British mandate civil servant. His name's Peter Riley, speaking to me last week. The website of the fundamentalist Hasidic Orthodox Jewish sect, that's Shabbat Lubavitch, he was talking about there, can be found at shabbat.org. That's shabad.org and shabbat.org.uk, amongst other sites. Now, joining me is Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers still, again. Martin, the Israelis don't want peace. That's the accusation he's making there.
Well, they don't want peace unless it's on their terms, which means that you want war, because basically if you're not prepared to compromise, you have to fight, don't you?
And is it actually, do you think there's any credibility to what he's saying about it actually being almost an apartheid state, which is designed for Jewish people and not Arabs?
Well, they openly say that it is, so, you know, we should take them at their word, shouldn't we?
And what about this, obviously there are quite a few Jewish people who are actually supporting the Palestinian cause in one way or another. Gilad Atzmon is one of them.
Yes, he's a jazz musician based in Britain. He's Jewish and he's very hostile to Israeli government policy, as many Jews around the world are, and many people inside Israel. One really fantastic Israeli voice for reason is Uri Avenry, who was originally a right-wing Jewish nationalist, a terrorist actually, who killed many British soldiers. But he's very, very clear that if his own country is not prepared to make peace with the Palestinians, they deserve, you know, to fight and to lose. And because he's a traitor from the right wing in Israel, he's hated by the right wing, bitterly hated, but he's actually a very, very humane man, and if people can find his stuff on the internet, he's one of the voices of reason in Israel.
The idea of a rabbi encouraging people to smash down the Al-Aqsa Mosque and things like this is a little bit worrying. Why don't we hear about this so much as the Muslim extremists?
Because we're being bombarded with war propaganda by governments, aren't we? It's all about poor little Belgium and the Hun raping Belgian nuns, isn't it? When we look back at the war propaganda that people were subjected to in previous wars, we can always see how silly it is. But when we're being bombarded with it by our own media while it's happening, we all lose our marbles and go along with it all. We are riding towards a Middle East war which could turn into a world war. People really need to face up to this. As the dollar collapses, as the world economy tanks out, we could be going to World War III. And what we really need to do is take a step back and take a deep breath. But that's not what's happening, is it?
If there is a World War III focused around the Middle East, what do you think is going to be the main protagonist?
Well, obviously, they're lining Iran up to be attacked. I mean, that's quite clear. But the Iranians were going to give them some very nasty surprises, I suspect.
That's all for this week. Coming up, the Sky News at 7. Thanks to our guest in the first hour. That was Labour MP for Bristol East and Shadow Treasury Minister Kerry McCarthy. And, of course, to all who you just heard, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers there. Next week, the businessman and recently uncharacteristically media-shy chairman of University Bristol Hospital Trust's John Savage comes under the spotlight in our final show before the AV referendum and local elections. We'll also be dishing the dirt on some local councillors who have refused to come on this show. So that's all for this week. Have a very lovely and happy Easter holiday. The podcasts for this show are at thisweek.org.uk. Thanks very much for listening. See you next week.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody